Gautam Mahatha from Berkeley. And the speaker is Output Deterministic Replay from Multi-Core Debugging. Okay, sound check. Can people in the back hear me? Okay, great. Hi, I'm Gautam Altakar, and in the previous talk, you heard about one way to do multiprocessor deterministic replay. I'd like to tell you about another way to do it. All right, so we all know that debugging is very difficult. Debugging non-deterministic software is even more difficult. Well, why is that? Because this type of software tends to have bugs that are hard to reproduce. You run your program in production, it crashes, but then when you're trying to reproduce it, it doesn't crash anymore. Now, this is really frustrating because now you can't employ traditional cyclic debugging techniques. That is, you can't rerun your program in order to home in on the root cause of the failure. So in this talk, I'd like to focus on the problem of reproducing non-deterministic failures. So to address this problem, we employ deterministic replay technology. The goal of a deterministic replay system is to generate a replica of some original program program run, and hence the failures in that run. Now briefly, these systems operate in two phases, a record phase and a replay phase. During the record phase, the system runs a program and logs non-deterministic data, such as inputs and thread interleavings, to a log file. Now later, when the user wants to reproduce the failure, he starts up a replay session, and the system runs the application, but this time uses the information in the log file to drive the execution, to make it do the same thing. Now, at this point, you're probably wondering why deterministic replay? Why not use model checking, testing, and verification to find the bugs before you deploy to production? Well, as good as these tools are, they aren't perfect, right? They miss bugs. And when that happens, these bugs go into production, resulting in failure. And at that point, you'll need deterministic replay to reproduce those production failures. Okay, so we want deterministic replay. What exactly are we looking for in the ideal deterministic replay system? So there are four things. Foremost, we want multiprocessor operation. Why? Because concurrency is on the rise. Practically every machine you can get has multiple cores nowadays. Second, we want efficient recording. Why? Because we want to reproduce production bugs, and so the system can't incur too much recording overhead. Third, we shouldn't require any special hardware, because, well, we want to use it on commodity machines today. And last but not least, we want to replay arbitrary applications, even those with the most notorious form of non-determinism, data races. So it turns out that meeting all of these requirements is pretty challenging. Most replay systems have had to trade off one of these requirements in order to get the others. For example, some systems don't support multiple CPUs. They can take advantage of only one CPU. That was great about a couple of years ago, but now not so much. Some systems trade off record efficiency. Again, these systems are still useful for development use, but if you want to reproduce production bugs, still not as useful. Third, some systems require special hardware, right? And this is great if Intel or AMD decides to adopt these changes. But currently, these systems exist only in simulation. You can't use them on your x86 box at home. And finally, some systems assume that the program doesn't have data races, or the programmer knows where these data races are. May work for some simple applications, but it turns out that realistic apps have lots of data races. If not errors, then benign data races. So what do we do? So we've actually built a user-level deterministic replay system. It's called ODR. It meets all of the requirements that we mentioned before. Multiple CPUs, efficient recording about 1.6x slowdown. Doesn't require any special hardware. And it replays real Linux x86 applications. Apps like Apache and Java, MySQL. These applications have lots of benign data risks. Okay, so what makes our system tick? Well, the key intuition is that for debugging purposes, we don't really need a precise replica of the original program run. It often suffices, again, for debugging purposes, to produce some run that exhibits the same output. Now, there's a caveat. is that we don't guarantee that the replay run reproduces the exact same bug. But nonetheless, this is sufficient to guarantee that it will reproduce a bug that led to the failure. And so we still think it's useful. Okay, so I've told you, give you the basic idea of the system, the intuition. How do we take this intuition and turn it into an approach? So the idea that we don't need a perfect replica motivates our approach of relaxing the determinism requirements, okay? Now, this is not a new idea, I should stress that. Most replay systems, in fact, all that I know of, relax determinism requirements to some degree. And in fact, early work by Stone, and more recently the Perez folks, the talk before, extend this boundary even further, okay? The boundary of relaxation. Now, in our work, we take this to its extreme. In our work, we say, okay, the replay run can be pretty different. It can be very different, in fact, so long as it produces the same outputs. So the outputs are the key in our work. Okay, so what exactly do I mean by relaxing the determinism requirements? Well, let's take a look at an example. So in this example, you have thread 1. It acquires an input, writes it into variable x. And then thread 2 reads from variable x, takes the square root of the value, and then if it's 4, prints an error, okay? Now, I should point out that there is a data erase in this program on the variable x, which means that when you rerun it with the same input, it may or may not produce the output error, right? Depending on how the data erase evaluates the second time around. Now, under the classic guarantee, which we call value determinism, the replay run and the original run must read and write the same values from memory. So, for example, if the original run acquired an input of 2, then the replay run must also acquire an input of 2. If the original run read a value of 2 for the racing read of x, then the replay run must also read a value of 2. That's value determinism. We relax it to output determinism. And output determinism simply says that the original and the replay run produce the same output. In this case, if the original produces error, the error message, then the replay also produces the error message. Now, in general, when I say outputs, I'm referring to any user-visible effects, such as, you know, things like segmentation faults, board dumps, console error messages, that type of thing. Now, I should stress that output determinism isn't perfect. It doesn't make guarantees about the ordering of values of the replay execution. For example, if the original acquired input of 2, then it's perfectly valid under output determinism to acquire an input of negative 2. Well, why is that okay? Because negative 2 times negative 2 is still 4 and results in the output of error being printed out. Also, there's no guarantees on the ordering either. So under output determinism, it's perfectly legal for the thread 2 to read a value of negative 2 before it's been written by thread 1. It's wacky. So it's not perfect, but nevertheless, we think it's still useful for debugging for two reasons. One is that it reproduces visible signs of the failure, such as the error message. And two, it provides values that are consistent with the failure. This is very important because now you can use it to reason backward from the failure to the root cause by looking at the values, right? So if you see the error message being printed out, you say, well, why was it printed out? Oh, because thread 2 loaded value negative 2. Negative 2 times negative 2 is 4. Why was negative 2 loaded? Well, because thread 1 wrote the value of negative 2 into x, and so on and so forth. So why is output determinism a good thing? Well, if we don't, under output determinism, we don't have to reproduce the same values, right? It's a relaxation. And that means we don't have to record them. We don't have to capture them. And as a result, we don't have to make the same trade-offs that traditional replay systems have had to make. And hence, we can meet all of the requirements simply by relaxing from value determinism to output determinism. All right, so at this point, I've told you what we're trying to do, but how do we do it? And the key challenge here is, how do we get the program to produce the same outputs if we don't know what the original values were? How do we do that? So to pull this off, we leverage an inference procedure, an offline inference procedure. It's called deterministic run inference, or DRI for short. And the basic idea is that you give DRI a query that contains information about the original run, minimally the outputs of the original run. DRI will then produce a determinant, non-deterministic data, such as thread interleaving, input values, and read values, that can then be used later to produce an output deterministic run. Okay, so what's the basic idea? How does it work exactly? So two simple steps. In the first step, we take the program and we translate it into a logical formula, also known as a verification condition. Okay, this logical formula expresses the relationship between the program outputs and non-deterministic data, such as the schedule input and read trace. Now, in our case, we know what the original output is. It's in the query. We've recorded it. We don't know what the schedule input and read traces are. So to find out, we send this formula to a formula solver, or theorem prover, if you will, and the solver will then compute concrete values for these non-deterministic data. And then we can use it to drive future executions to make them produce the same output. All right, so the key question is, how do we get this thing to scale to realistic applications, which have lots of inputs, reads, and interleavings? So the first technique that we use is to redirect the inference using more information from the original run. So to give you an extreme example, this is just extreme, suppose we know all of the inputs and the entire read trace of the original run. Well then, given that information, we can substitute it into the formula wholesale, and hence eliminate two out of the three unknowns. So now we only have to infer the schedule trace. The second technique is that we relax the memory consistency of the inferred run. Okay, so to give an extreme example, consider the known consistency memory model, in which the values a thread reads from memory could be have nothing to do with values previously written to it. So, for example, thread 2 may read a value of 5, even though 5 was never written to that location previously. This is wacky, but it has the advantage that now the values read from memory have nothing to do with scheduling order, the thread interleaving. And as a result, we can pick an arbitrary schedule interleaving, and hence knock out one of the three unknowns. So those are the two techniques, and two extreme examples of how to use those techniques. The key question then is, well, how much should we direct the search in practice, and how much should we relax the memory consistency? And these questions open the door to a three-dimensional trade-off space, as you see here. Now, in this space, the first dimension is the query complexity. How much should we have in the query to direct the search? Minimally, we need the outputs. We're shooting for output determinism. But maximally, we need the entire schedule, input, and read trace. The second dimension is the degree of memory consistency. Ideally, we would target a strict, consistent run, but we could, in fact, go all the way down to null consistency where the values are completely nonsensical. And the third design dimension is inference time, obviously, divided up to polynomial and exponential. Now, in our initial exploration of the space, we target two points. The first point is called search intensity DRI, SIDRI for short. Now, SIDRI, in the worst case, may take exponential time, but the benefit is that it has low record mode overhead. In particular, it needs only the input, output, and lock order of the original run. It also has the benefit that it doesn't relax the target memory consistency too much. It goes to lock order, which is pretty close to strict order, strict consistency. The second dimension, the second design point, is called query-intensive DRI. And QI-DRI is very similar to search-intensive DRI, except that it also records a path. And that makes a huge difference because it allows QIDRI to achieve polynomial time inference. Okay, so how do these schemes work? So SIDRI, basic idea, you give it the output, the input, and the lock order of the original run. Right? Now given the input, it just takes it and substitutes it into the formula, reducing one of the major unknowns. Given the lock order, it can't just substitute it into the schedule trace because the lock order is a partial order. And the schedule trace has to be a total order. So before we substitute, we just take the log order and we linearize it. We obtain a total order consistent with that log order. Then we substitute. So at this point, we have two out of three unknowns knocked out. The only thing SIDRI needs to infer is the read trace. QIDRI is very similar, except that it has the path. And it uses the path to narrow the search space of read traces. In particular, because it knows the path, it need now only consider those read traces conforming to that given path, and not to all paths. Okay, so I've given you a basic idea of how two schemes in the design space work. How do they perform? Well, SIDRI is, not surprisingly, very slow. overhead, the inference time varies from 400x slowdown compared to the original execution time to 60,000x for just 1 second run. Now, there are two interesting things about this graph. So first of all, the key bottleneck is formula generation, not formula solving time. This is atypical of inference techniques where a majority of the time is spent in formula solving. The other interesting aspect is that there's high variance. Some applications perform tremendously better than others. Apache, for example, 400x versus Java, 60,000x. Why is that? Well, the key result, the key detail you need to understand in order to make sense of these results is that in order to generate the formula, all right, we employ a multi-path symbolic execution. This symbolic execution tries to find an output deterministic path, a path capable of producing the original output. Right? And it doesn't always succeed on the first try, so it has to backtrack. Now, why is formula generation high? Well, because in general, we need to do a lot of backtracking. And each backtrack is very expensive, about 200x. Why is there a high variance? Well, because not a lot of applications require backtracking. MIG J2, for example, doesn't require any backtracking at all. So in that case, inference time is very low. All right, so at this point, you're probably wondering, well, what causes a backtrack? What triggers it? Well, the main reason is that when we're doing the symbolic execution, when we're executing the program to generate the formula, the program may diverge. It may take a different path than the original. And as a result, it may miss output points. Okay? That means that that path is incapable or likely to be incapable of producing the original output. And at that point, we need to backtrack. Now, we can backtrack, of course, to the most recent branch, but instead, we make the observation that these divergences are caused by branches influenced by races, right? Because during symbolic execution, these races evaluate differently, hence causing the branches to evaluate differently themselves. So, with this observation, rather than backtrack to the most recent branch, we backtrack to the most recent race-tainted branch. The idea is that eventually, the execution will converge on an output deterministic path, a divergence-free path that is capable of producing the original output. All right, so what about QIDRI? I just told you about SIDRI. Well, it turns out it does remarkably better, in fact, two orders of magnitude better than SIDRI. Well, why is that? Well, because QIDRI knows the original execution's path. All right, because it knows the path, it doesn't have to backtrack. It can generate the formula in one go. Right? So, but there is a penalty, right? There is a cost to doing this, and that's that we need to know the path. And in our current implementation, that incurs an overhead of around 6x. So those are two different points in the trade-off space. Now, the key question you're probably thinking is, well, inference time is pretty high. What can you do to make it better, right? Well, it turns out there are many things we haven't tried yet, right? Many silly things that we do. So, for example, one thing we can do to improve this is that we can try and find a middle ground between recording the path and not recording the path. And this is based on the observation that only a few branches in a program's execution are tainted by races. So if we know the outcomes of those race-tainted branches, then we wouldn't have to record the entire path, and we would be able to avoid backtracking. Now, the question is, well, how do you predict this? And so that would be the future work aspect of it. Another thing we could do to improve it would be to improve the cost of each backtrack. Because currently, when we do a backtrack, we identify RTVs for the entire execution before the divergence point. But then in future backtracks, we do the analysis over again, so we don't reuse the analysis results from previous iterations. This is a really silly thing to do, but this is a major cause of the floating that we can probably easily fix. And finally, there's a very simple thing we can do. We can parallelize the formula generation. That is, on a divergence, we can fork in the most recent RTV and try and generate formulas concurrently along each path. So with that, I'd like to recap with the key ideas of this work, and that's that if we relax the determinism requirements, that is, if we shoot for output determinism rather than value determinism, then we can get record-efficient multiprocessor replay. Right? There is a cost. Inference time is high, but we think there are many things that can be tried, and so we think there's much promise in this direction. With that, I'll stop, and I'll take your questions.
So So I'm trying to understand the memory consistency model, where you said you can put in arbitrary values. So if I put in 5 for x and 2 for y, just some arbitrary values, how do I know my object invariants are maintained? Like the programmer wrote the code with some object invariants in mind. How are you capturing those if you substitute arbitrary values?
We don't actually so that was an extreme example that we showed. No consistency, that's what you're referring to, right?
Yes.
So we substitute arbitrary values. Okay, well, let's go with that. Suppose we didn't target null consistency. We substituted arbitrary values. Now, typically, if an invariant is violated, right, in your program, it might crash, right? But according to output determinism, when we compute these values, they will be computed such that the program produces the same output. So if it didn't crash originally, or if it didn't fire an assert, then it won't fire an assert in the replay run. Now,
I guess I'm not sure how I understand how you initialize the memory. And my question is sort of carrying over the persistent state as well. If you have persistent state, how do you initialize that as well when you do a replay? I'm basically trying to understand how you initialize memory, any kind of state you have. I'm not so sure I got how you do that.
Initialize. But now, what do you mean by initialize?
Well, when you're doing the rerun,
right?
You have to initialize some state. Let's say I have a persistent state, I have some state in the file system or database.
Okay.
How do I?
In our current system, we don't try and infer the values of file system data. We simply record the return values of system calls, for example. And so we use those wholesale. But you can imagine something in which those values are inferred, but we don't do that in the two design points that we've explored so far.
Thank you. Peter Chen, University of Michigan. I'll ask a similar question to what I asked the last presenter, which is your results or your techniques are similar in that you're trying to produce output or according to some criteria from press, but in fact there's some analogy between, say, formula generation and backtracking versus kind of this feedback-based search. So can you describe as to why the results are so different?
Okay, I have a similar question as well, but I can guess. So in our approach, when we do a backtrack, we do an RTB analysis. We try and find race data branches for the entire execution up to the point of divergence. Okay. It could be that they obtain better results because I think they hinted in the paper that they don't do a race analysis for the entire execution. They save it up until the part to the region that they backtrack to. So they reuse results from previous iterations. Another explanation potentially is that we don't just do race detection. We do race detection plus taint flow propagation in order to identify race tainted branches. So there's more analysis for each backtracking iteration in our approach than theirs. And we do some sort of things like not reusing the analysis results from previous iterations. So that could explain it. If we were to reduce each of these things, maybe we could explore more iterations per second. But that's just my guess on how they are.
Quantum generic and SARP, it seems that the essence of their technique is not necessarily getting out of foot to determinism, but rather recording certain events in the program and then trying to get those events to be the same in the replay. And the reason I mention this is that if you want, for example, to replay a program that leads to a deadlock, there's no output there. But I think you could use your techniques for just using different set of events to record the output events, and it can be working.
Right, so you can imagine where the output, a situation in which the output is not the criteria you're looking for. Maybe it's, some user-defined, like a deadlock scenario, right? That's a criteria that you're searching for. Right now we're searching for outputs, but I think you're suggesting that, okay, sometimes you're not looking for outputs, you're looking for user-defined criteria such as deadlocks where there are no outputs. Is this right?
Yeah, or this is you can choose, for example, function calls or you can choose even
recorded. Yeah, that's possible, but the reason why we went with outputs is that, and a lot of times in production runs, we don't really know where the failures are going to occur, and we don't really know what we're looking for. I guess you could make a case that, okay, well, I'm interested in deadlocks and you know, certain function calls and assertion failures and things like that, and then you can narrow it to that. And that would be a way of actually reporting even less than the others. Because then you can just, you know, narrow down the criteria that you're looking for to report just that. So yeah, that is a good point.
Okay, so now I'm new, so let's take the... Well, what's the last question? It's a quick one.
Dean Duncan from the University of Illinois. Very nice talk. I'm wondering if you consider like changing your set analysis, changing your smart diffusion algorithm to some other set analysis algorithm that significantly improve your formula generation time. The problem with, I think the goal with the smart diffusion is to find the path that can output, that can produce the exact output trace. However, the problem is that, for example, in our program, there might be some executions, some code that in the beginning that are actually irrelevant to the output. But your smart execution always starts from the start, so it might be spending a lot of time. But if you change your stack analysis, for example, more like target oriented, just starting from those output statements, and maybe like to expand your stack analysis, so that you can significantly reduce your time.
Right. So
the reason. Answer quickly.
Yeah. You're right. We are considering static approaches to formula generation, such as classical verification condition generation, just by looking at formula statically without actually running. And I'll talk to you more about detail about that.
Okay. I think we'll have to stop it there. We have 58 minutes for lunch. Be quickly, hurry back for the working progress session.
Okay.